guessing, a chain for a foot and a chain for a hand. We don't know. We just don't know how these two chains were used, but that is now my third favorite picture of what it may have been to be in captivity. Yet I particularly like this because you see it shows a fair degree of freedom, the ability to have people come and visit on a regular basis, the ability for Paul to be writing his letters, which we'll see him doing here in the next few weeks as we get to the end of this book. And so the chart at the top, or the words at the top, you have seen the last 2 weeks in a row. I think it's well for us to remember that he did spend 4.5 years in captivity here in the last chapters of the book of Acts, starting in chapter 1, verse 27, where he's arrested in Jerusalem through the end of chapter 28, the end of the book then. You know, Paul is under arrest of varying degrees and types. Now, we're going to go through a whole series of pictures here, which I don't believe you've seen before, but which are about a city that we've talked about before, which is Caesarea Maritima. If you look in Acts chapter 23 and see there at verse 32, the next day, this is chapter 23 now, leading into 24, 23:32, the next day, leaving the horsemen to go on with him, they returned to the barracks, and when these had come to Caesarea and delivered the letter to the governor, they also presented Paul to him. When he had read it, he asked him what province he was, and when he learned that he was from Cilicia, he said, I will give you a hearing after your accusers arrive also, giving orders for him to be kept in Herod's praetorium, which is another word for palace slash, you know, prison or courthouse. The praetorium is best thought of as a fortified facility that is where you put arrested people. But it's also a sort of a courthouse and a barracks kind of thing, too. This is not it. Okay, but Caesarea Maritima is the city by the sea. Maritima. Caesarea by the sea, named after the Caesar, is the premier archaeological site in all of Israel. There's only one other place that could possibly rival it, and most of it is still completely buried. It's under sand. That's the city of Ashkelon. But this city, much of it has been excavated, and so you can go to Caesarea Maritima and get a tremendously clear understanding of what Paul was looking at while he was there. The very stones that you see are the same stones that Paul would have seen. Now, this particular structure is actually outside of Caesarea and some miles away, but this is a part of the aqueduct. I just wanted you to notice how high this is. In Caesarea, the water supply was brought from 8 miles away. The Romans were so skillful in the production of their structures, but in their engineering skills, that they were able to put a very slight incline for 8 miles and bring water down to the city of Caesarea. So outside of Caesarea, you'll see how tall that is. In the next picture, this is where it ends in the city of Caesarea itself. This is now the beach that you're standing on as it comes right along the waterfront there. And you can see it's very much shorter. The arch is now not nearly so tall as they were a third the height that they were some miles away. But Don and I saw this structure now. You can see at the very top that the kind of V-shape right there is because this is the actual water channel that ran for 8 miles out beyond where you actually even can see here in this particular picture. You see it runs right along the coast and all the way out to Mount Carmel, most famous, of course, for Elijah's confrontation with the prophets of Baal. And so this structure is just one of many that are very well preserved and, you know, built in the by Herod the Great 2,000 years ago, still standing. Now this is an aerial shot, obviously, the Colosseum that Herod built. You know, this is of significance to us, of course, because, again, Paul came to this town on numerous occasions, other saints did. This structure has been standing since Herod the Great built it. So when Paul comes into Caesarea now under arrest, that's the structure that would have been among the most prominent that he would have noticed. Now, I want you to see, though, this area right here now, this big wall that separated that one area from the other. This is the palace area that Herod built. And this is the area in which Paul certainly would have come to meet with two governors and to deal, you know, with the circumstances of the chapters that we're now going to be facing here as he has come just to this town. See how you have a very easily recognizable rectangular shape right here, and then beyond it, you just have what looks to be kind of a tidal flat, you know, tidal pool sort of an area. Okay, that area, in an artist's rendition, we're going to be looking at right now. It's actually a straight-on aerial view that I put the arrow in to show. That's the area that you're next going to see in this artist's rendition. Now, what this represents in this particular schematic, here's that rectangular area that you're just looking at. Highly recognizable, easily identifiable today. But that other part that I referred to as a tidal area, that area now, virtually everything that was built out onto that promontory is now gone, except for this area right here, which we can still recognize. That was Herod's promontory palace and the pool that was within it. So here's another artist's rendition of that large rectangular area, but this is the secondary rectangular area now missing. This structure, you know, we can see the outline of it at least. But all of this right here was an open-air facility with the columns so that you could stand in shade if you wanted underneath this area. And the pool is right inside there. So he had his own private, huge swimming facility that had shaded areas for people to lounge around, you know, by the poolside as well. Today, all we have is the rocks right there. This was the palace structure. All of it right there. In a minute, what I want you to take notice of is this higher wall right here and what would be hidden behind it immediately on the other side of that wall. This is an aerial photograph. Farrell Jenkins and I, on my second trip to Israel, chartered an aircraft. Something very unusual to do, security issues and all that kind of stuff going on. Very few people get into this. But Farrell took 4,000 photographs while he and I were 3 hours in the air over Israel. This was the first location we actually flew to. So you get certainly an impression of how beautiful and clear that Mediterranean is at this location. But there's the theater. Here is that rectangular structure that still exists, only the foundation and just the lowest courses of the old wall. And then this is the promontory palace as well, and you can still see just the remnants of the rectangular area right here. That was the pool. So it would have been covered with a mosaic floor, marble, you know, floor of some kind, and then all around it would be those porticos, and likely even more facility out here, which all of this stuff that you see, much of this underwater, would be debris from the old structures, which is now, you know, falling down into the sea. As a matter of fact, about 3 or 4 years ago, they actually began underwater tours of Caesarea Maritima. So if you have a scuba license in the United States or any other country, you can come over there and book a tour. The guys will pick you out, and they have statues and columns and various things that are long underwater now, that you can go down with your scuba gear. They have signs set up underwater that you can read. So, where all the richer tourists here are doing up here, you can actually go down and go underneath now. And we actually saw some people doing that while we were there. Okay, but what I want you to notice also in this picture is this area right here. This is the hippodrome. These are the actual bleachers, stones, that everybody sat on for the chariot races that took place. Here are the remnants of the center section run here that, you know, they were running around. And so this is a magnificent photo. In all the internet, you will not find photographs as high quality as the ones that Farrell took. Very high quality equipment, you know, and then we were telling the pilot where to go to get these shots. So that's as good as it'll ever get in giving you a view of where Paul was. Now again, here's this rectangular facility that is the palace itself. Remember I told you on the far side of the wall of the artist's sketch, is this area right here, very square right there, and then rounded as you have the seats for the hippodrome where the chariot races were held. And you can also just barely notice right there a circle. And what we're going to do is zoom in on that area now. So it's the exact same photograph, just coming closer. But do you see right here this structure in that round area right there? There's a pavement that has been uncovered right there. That is believed to be, it is really highly likely, that that is the actual area that Paul would have met with first Felix and then Festus in the event that we're about to be studying. Now, fear not, I'm taking a lot of time with this, I know, but we have an unusually short chapter for the book of Acts here. It's going to be very straightforward, so let me go ahead and take the time. This is what Paul was looking at. Columns from Herod's day still exist. I'll show you those in just a minute. This pathway right here you'll be looking at in just a minute, the photograph I took standing on that pathway. As you come in, the main entrance, everybody walks over to the theater first, and as you come out, you go through here, then you go to the hippodrome, you walk for about a quarter mile or more to Cabin Beach to see other facilities that we're not dealing with here today. So, here again is the upper palace, the pool would be down here. Here's that paved area with that circle that I mentioned a moment ago. And zooming in one more time, get kind of fuzzy now, even as high quality as this was, you know, mentioning you run out of gas. These are just people standing around in some tourist group and looking now at the paved area with this circle right here. And brethren, this we think is likely, quite possibly, actually where Paul stood when he was meeting with Felix and with Festus. This is thought to be what would be the judicial area, the receiving area, the judgment hall at the time of Herod building it, and then the Romans continuing in successive generations to the time of Paul right there. So this is that round structure that we've been looking at, you know, from space. You know, what it was, if it was a mount for a, you know, location for a throne that's been since removed, or a fire pit, you know, I mean, I don't know what it was, but it existed this day. You can see the paving that this man is standing on, and then this area right here, okay? Excavations continue to this day, so things are coming to light virtually each and every year. This photograph is just to give you, you know, a close-up of the paving stones themselves. Now right there, you know, it doesn't look like much. You see, it was a bunch of flat rocks, and I got prettier ones in my backyard. Yeah, you probably do. But, you know, bear in mind that there's 2,000 years of weathering on this thing, too. In the time of Herod the Great, these are the stones that Paul would have been looking at. But Paul would have been looking at a surface that was probably a quarter or half an inch, you know, above what we see now. All the rest having been worn off in the course of all of these years. But that's the area. This is the wall and that concrete walkway I was telling you about, so that on the other side is the Colosseum right there. So this gets you down to ground level, and the big natural gas plant, I think it is. I don't know where the bar is. But this is where Paul, with 90% certainty, you know, stood as he was working with Felix and with Festus. This is that smaller area I pointed out to you, and it had a different mosaic that they're uncovering now. And so this concrete has been cast in there to preserve the parts that have been untouched for 2,000 years. The rest of this is missing, but they'll be excavating elsewhere, you know, working with it as time goes by. But you get at least a little bit of a feel for the grandeur and the luxury of this place. It was just phenomenal. It just rivals any place you've ever been, you know, to this very day. And this is a sign, a photograph taken of the sign that's at that location. It says in 58 A.D., the Apostle Paul, accused of having caused a riot, was sent to Caesarea to be tried by the governor. Being a Roman citizen, Paul demanded to be heard at the emperor's court. He sailed to Rome from Caesarea's harbor. There he was tried a few years later, executed. Be 10 years from this point, and they're covering several chapters of Acts and then some. This hall may well be the place of hearing mentioned in the Acts of the Apostles. And I really have no doubt that it is that location. That might have been some other room, might have been
you know, that, that special arrangements were made, but likely, because he's a fairly average prisoner at this time, that would have been the location that you would have taken such a man. And here's that sidewalk I was telling you about. Again, these are the columns that Aaron himself had built with far higher, of course, and all the roof structure and everything has come down. All the interior walls are gone now. But this man is standing out in that area we were just talking about. There's that sign that has to do with paving. It's this area right here, kind of from this guy to that guy, all that area that we've just been looking at in the close-up. And again, a little farther back to give you the step down for the area where the pool is, just out here, you know, so that was the second half of the palace there. Okay, now, these pictures are not from the palace. They're from the quarter mile down the beach at the far end of the hippodrome where other structures are. Commerce took place down there where that artificial harbor had been built. And so this, you know, is not part of the palace, but it comes from the same time frame and will give you a feel then for services that have endured and still have the first century finish to them. So while the other place is rough, it got hurt worse through the centuries, this begins to give you an idea of the polished stones that you would have seen, of the mosaic, extremely ornate, very beautiful, that just covered Caesarea's enormous complex. Here is a structure that's out on part of the artificial reef that was built out there for the incoming commerce. This would have been a very different building, not one that Herod was living in. And then I think I've got one more picture for you here, again, to give you an idea of just how amazing this would have been. It's nicer than any, you know, state capital that you've ever been in. It's extremely impressive. Paul has come here now to begin 4.5 years, 58-62, dealing with his bondage, the various problems that he's going to be facing. Is that the last one? It is. Okay, so let's turn to Acts chapter 24. We won't have any more slides. We'll just be going through the chapter itself, which, as you see, has only 27 verses, so a little short one. Chapter 24, verse 1. After 5 days, so he had to wait a bit, you know, for this these people to arrive and for this trial to take place or the hearing. After 5 days, the high priest Ananias came down with some elders. Anybody ever heard of him before? Sure, same guy that had put Jesus to death, played a major role in having him condemned. He himself comes down with some elders, with a certain attorney named Tertullus, and they brought charges to the governor against Paul. So here we go again. Here we go again. With the Jews coming to a Roman authority of great power, in this case, the governor himself, Felix, and they've come as well prepared as they can get. They've got the highest of power, you know, attorney they know, and so here's Tertullus himself to accuse him. And they say in the middle of verse 2, since we have through you attained much peace, and since by your providence reforms are being carried out for this nation, we acknowledge in every way and everywhere, most excellent Felix, with all thankfulness. So they present themselves, you know, as just abjectly beholden to this man. You are the greatest thing that's ever walked the earth. You know, you and the Romans that have given us so many good things. And so you brought us peace, and you are providing reforms for us. And so we're just grateful, and you're most excellent, Felix. You know, so now we got all of the excuse me, all the flattery's been delivered. And verse 4, but that I may not weary you any further. Now, brethren, you know, it's been a while since somebody set about to tell me how truly magnificent I was that I got tired of it very quickly. You may find the same thing when people go on and on and on about how great you are. Okay, well, it doesn't happen for me anymore than it does for you, I guess. But, you know, it's more of this just flattery stuff. It's just another way of saying, you know, you're so important that, you know, I want to be in your way. Who is Felix talking to here? Well, who's he listening to? It's Tertullus. Who's there with him? among the Jews, who is the highest ranking, most powerful person in the entire nation? Ananias. So, this is really a serious amount of flattery, too. You know, here I am. I am a personage of enormous significance, and Felix knows it. This guy's no dummy. He knows that what this man Ananias says, and what that lawyer, Tertullian, you know, are arguing for, the Jews are going to know about. And if he doesn't want to have a rebellion on his hands, if he doesn't want to have trouble that can get him killed because Caesar's unhappy, you fail to keep the peace in this area, you know, he knows that he is dealing with sort of veiled threats at the same time. It's a lot of smarmy flattery, but it's the highest ranking, currently, the two highest ranking authorities, you know, in the area. Now we got King Agrippa that we're going to hear about later in the book of Acts, and he is higher in a sense, but at this moment, these two come together. You're looking at the governor, you're looking at the high priest, you're looking at the Roman authority, you're looking at the Jewish authority, and you are looking at a summit meeting like few summit meetings have ever been. And so still, you know, I don't want to weary you, but he's also saying, everybody understands, you know, political speech, this is really big. You're looking at the best lawyer in Jerusalem, and you're looking at the high priest of the Jewish people. So I beg you to grant us, in verse 4, by your kindness, a brief hearing. So it's all, you know, very polite, but it's big. So in verse 5, we have found this man a real pest. Now let me stop right there. So the Supreme Court's going to meet. You're going to have a meeting with the governor. All right? And your first charge against the guy in this highest of high-level meetings is, we charge him with being a pest. I know I'm just imagining, but I can just see Felix's face right now. One eye around goes up, you go, huh? Pest? You have brought to me a pest? Pest should be taken care of by the gardener. A pest is a rodent. A pest is an insect. You know, if he's pestilential, what are you talking to me for? I am not a pest remover, okay? I'm the governor. I deal with things that are a little bit bigger than this. So I'm thinking this just really has to have his attention here. But then they add, who stirs up dissension. Well, now is the eyebrow coming down a little bit? Yeah, all right. Well, now you're getting into my world a little bit here. I have been sent over here by Caesar, charged with the responsibility of seeing, and none of that happens. There's not going to be any dissension among the Jews. This is my job. Among how many Jews? Well, now it's all the Jews. And then they add, throughout the what? Throughout the world. Now, by the way, brethren, this word for world here in verse 5, tremendously interesting and significant. We are not going to get into it today. There are three words that can be translated world or earth in the New Testament. This is one of the three. But this is the one that is used by Luke when in chapter 2, he says that at the time of the birth of Jesus, there was an order that went out into the entire world that a census should be taken, ordered by the Caesar of Rome. What oikoumene did the Caesar of Rome have power over? The word is oikoumene. It's translated world. What world did he have power over? The planet? No, the what? The Roman Empire. And the word is world. It's all right to translate it world. As long as you understand, you know, it's the American world, it's the European world, it's the Russian world, it's the Jewish world, it's the Roman world, but it is a world with varying boundaries that are localized somewhere on the surface of the earth. It doesn't mean planet. Never means planet. Now, notice, though, what he's just said, that he's a pest. Well, yeah, he's a pest, But he stirs up dissension among all the Jews throughout the what?
Throughout the Roman Empire. Now what have Tertullus and the high priest just said to this man? Your trouble is bigger than this. It's bigger than your territory. This is not a local problem. This is a Roman Empire problem. Now, the Jews, are they throughout the Roman Empire? And in significant numbers, aren't they? Okay? So again, the what he's done is with all this obsequious language, you know, about, oh, I'm just your humble slave, you know, I eat dust under your shoes. What he's actually doing is establishing here, with all the fancy talk, this is huge, huge, and it goes beyond you. So you better figure this out and handle it properly, because if you don't, you'll be hearing from Caesar, and we'll make sure you do. Because this is the high priest who is high priest over the Jews of, check the box, Jerusalem, Judea, Galilee, yeah, Israel, yeah. How about Alexandria in Egypt? Yes. And the Jews in Rome? Yes. And everywhere in between, both in northern Africa and in what we think of as Europe today. Okay, so, you know, it is a sort of a veiled threat, too, the way they're laying this down now. And a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes. Several different names are being used to identify this new people. Been around now for 20 years, 25 years, but, you know, they're relatively new people then on world stage, and so they haven't got a standard uniform name, and so Jesus comes from Nazareth. These are the Nazarenes then, the followers of him. He even tried to desecrate the temple. True or false? Bruce shaking his head vigorously over here. As false as anything could be. We've already dealt with all of that. And the centurion knew it. Everybody knows that's not true. Then we arrested him. True or false? True or false? We Jews arrested him. Absolutely false. What did the Jews do? Rioted, and the mob tried to kill him. They're going to stone him to death. Who arrested him? The centurion arrested him. So we didn't arrest him at all. It's two lies now, absolutely, you know, bold. And we wanted to judge him according to our own law. True or false? Absolutely false. What they wanted to do was to stone him to death. They got interrupted by the lawful Roman authority rescuing the man as he should have done and did do. Though he had told his lies in the letter we talked about last week. Covered his tracks too. But we also have here, now, we wanted to judge him according to our own law. What had the 40 men decided to do in a lawful assembly to judge Paul? They didn't even know that they what? Wouldn't eat until they'd killed him. Now, you all remember that judicial proceeding. A total pack of lies. So now at the highest levels of these two governments, we have these guys just, you know, being told lies. Here sits Felix trying to sift through all these lies on both sides. The centurion lying to him. The Jews are lying to him. And so then, in 7, Claudius Lysias, remembers his name, the commander came along and with much violence took him out of our hands. Wait a minute. Where did the violence start? All the violence was going on. What did Claudius Lysias do? Twice. He put an end to the violence that was taking place. So yeah, the soldiers had to get their weapons out, you know, but you were the ones that were rioting. You were the ones that were going to kill him. You were the violent people. And he came in and he put an end to it. So it took him out of our hands, ordering his accusers to come before you. So this is his fault. If you need to blame anybody, Claudius Lysias needs to go down. Now, I should just point out, in the middle of verse 6, just before the word and,
Did any of you have a symbol there with its compadre in the middle of verse 8, the end of that first sentence that ends with you there? Okay, you got what? You got a bracket. If you look in the footnote, many manuscripts do not contain the remainder of verse 6, all of verse 7, and that first line in verse 8. And so it may or may not be that it was in the original text right there. So while I'm picking on these guys, you know, I suppose it is possible that those words may not have been in the original text. But I rather suspect that they were. The fact that some manuscripts don't have it is more likely that words fell out than that they were inserted. Always remember that as a rule of thumb. Much more likely that it's there. It certainly doesn't say or teach anything that's any kind of threat to the veracity of the scriptures at all. At any rate, we now pick up in the middle of verse 8. By examining him yourself concerning all these matters, you will be able to ascertain the things of which we accuse him. Yeah, I just want to say one more thing about, you know, the initial setup here. This surprises me, and I don't get it, and so it's just something for you to think about. Brethren, this is the sharpest lawyer in town, I'm sure. He's with the high priest. You know, he's going to be the best that money can buy. He's also going to be in the priest's pocket. Okay? But these guys are not stupid, and it looks to me like that really is kind of stupid there at verse 8. So I'm not sure what's going on. By examining him yourself, which surely he will do, concerning all these matters, and we've got Romans all over Jerusalem. Claudius Lysias is one of them. They got soldiers that were sent there to protect Paul. Claudius not only sent a letter, he would surely have informed these men. You'll be able to ascertain the things of which we accuse him. Well, they just told a pack of lies on Claudius Lysias, and who is this Felix, the governor, likely to believe first? The Jews or a Roman centurion? I think, brethren, what it betrays is just this. Two things, probably. The fury of these men in their hatred for all things related to Christ. The just mind-numbing rage that make them lose their minds and resort to riot, and they're not being very smart here either. Okay? And the second thing there is just desperation, though. Because they really haven't got a very good case. You know, it sounds to me like they're just trying to prejudice him, maybe even hoping that he won't do this examination, by just claiming that if you go through such a thing, you'll see that we're right, we have no fear of that. It looks to me, you know, like it's desperate, it's rage. And then part of that desperation is the recognition that they haven't gotten much here, and they're maybe trying to just bamboozle him into just buying the great magnificence and high level of all of this, and don't you dare question us, if this is the way we say it happened, or that's the way it happened, you know, kind of an approach to things, hoping to bluff their way through it. But not very smart, really, because all this can be verified, and then they lose their case. But, in verse 9, and the Jews also joined in the attack, asserting that these things were so. So now they've called their witnesses, and these other guys, you know, have all been paid off to take care of this, so they're telling their story. Well, verse 10, when the governor nodded for him to speak, Paul responded. Now this is an interesting speech. It's an important one, and several that Paul gives here are of note. Not a very long one, but insightful. Knowing that for many years you've been a judge to this nation. So he's no dummy, he's been on at his post for quite a while. I cheerfully make my defense, since you can take note of the fact that no more than 12 days ago I went up to Jerusalem to worship. So it's not an old story. It's been totally 12 days is all we got here. And, you know, it's fresh, you can check it out. And in then, verse 12, neither in the temple nor in the synagogues, nor in the city. Did they find me carrying on a discussion with anyone or causing a riot? When Paul came into town, he went undercover. Very low key. He was not making a splash in that town. Not in the temple, not in the synagogues, not in the streets. It was only 12 days ago he even arrived there. Yet he spent the bulk of the last 12 days traveling down here, being under arrest, you know, and having problems. So I was only there a couple of days. It's pretty tough to be the new guy in town and touch off a riot in a couple of days. You know, and so, you know, I'm not guilty of the things that they're suggesting right here. I say touching off a riot. Did he touch off a riot? Well, I used the wrong word, that's why I got to correct myself. What really matters to this man is not a squabble among the Jews. What matters to him is dissension among all the Jews in the oikumene, the Roman world. So what he's finding out right off the bat here from Paul is, it's none of the above. Okay? So, he continues now, they didn't find me doing any of these things, nor, verse 13, can they prove to you the charges of which they now accuse me. So you just heard what they leveled at me, and I'm more than happy to, I'm cheerful to have you go and do this examination that they just mentioned. Listen to me like Paul is calling the Jewish lawyers bluff. I think that's what he's doing. He's saying, yeah, let's do that. Let's just do that. That sounds like a good idea. I'm not going to let those guys blow smoke in your face here. Let's just go ahead and do that. But this I do admit to you in verse 14. That according to the way, now, brethren, that term's going to be used more than once, and you'll notice they capitalize it in your Bible, maybe, because it is understood to have been another term like Nazarenes that people were using about these Christians. They had a new and different way of going about religion. But according to this way, which they call a sect, they call it just a subset split off from the Jewish religion. Paul would call it something very different, the fulfillment of it all. I do serve the God of our fathers, believing everything that is in accordance with the law and that is written in the prophets, having a hope in God, which these men cherish themselves, that there shall certainly be a resurrection of both the righteous and the what? And the wicked. Perfect. Now, big time note, brethren, to put in your Bible right here. So you stay at Acts chapter 24, and the verse that you're going to be looking at is verse 15. Now write C-S-E-E, or just put the verse numbers themselves. John, it's the Gospel of John, chapter 5, verses 24 through 29, which I'll read to you now. It's John 5, 24 to 29. Truly, truly, I say to you, he who hears my word and believes him who sent me has eternal life and does not come into judgment, but is passed out of death into life. Truly, truly, I say to you, Jesus, of course, an hour is coming and now is when the dead shall hear the voice of the Son of God and those who hear shall live. For just as the Father has life in himself, even so he gave to the Son also to have life in himself. And he gave him authority to execute judgment because he is the Son of Man. Do not marvel at this. For an hour is coming in which all who are in the tombs shall hear his voice and shall come forth. Those who did the good to a resurrection of life. Those who committed the evil to a resurrection of judgment. Here is Jesus in John 5 declaring emphatically what Paul just said in 24, or what I call it 15, okay? And also claiming Paul is, and therefore absolutely certain, who else believed that there would be a resurrection of both the good and the evil? So all the Jews believed that. He's also just declared that that's what the old law teaches. Well, he says, you know, really, they pitched their fit when I declared that I believed the Old Testament prophets about a resurrection which these men themselves also believe. Okay? So what does that tell you about Tertullus and the high priest convictions when it comes to a resurrection? Were they Sadducees or Pharisees? See, they were Pharisees in this regard. Now, in this regard, and you have to be careful because they play both sides, it might be a reference just to the Jews that came with him. The Sadducees typically were the priests and had control of the temple there. So whether or not the high priest was a Sadducee, I can't recall right now, you know, technically. But on this point, Paul says they're agreeing with me anyway on this resurrection thing. So then, to continue, we're running out of time. In 24, verse 16, in view of this, I also do my best to maintain always a blameless conscience before God and before men. After several years, I came to bring alms to my nation and to present offerings. Remember the collection for the poor among the saints in Jerusalem, in which they found me occupied in the temple, having been purified without any crowd or uproar. But there were certain Jews from Asia who ought to have been present before you, so now we know they're not, and to make accusation if they should have anything against me. Or else, verse 20, let these men themselves tell what misdeed they found when I stood before the council, other than for this one statement which I shouted out while standing among them, for the resurrection of the dead, I am on trial before you today. Well, you'll remember how he got everybody upset in dividing Sadducees from Pharisees. Now, 22, but Felix, having a more exact knowledge about the way, put them off, saying, when Lysias the commander comes down, I'll decide your case. Now, brethren, at that point, while we're talking about eyebrows, what do you suppose the Jewish eyebrows did? Yeah. Oh, no. He's going to call for Claudius Lysias. Well, we know they're in trouble now. 23, he gave orders to the centurion for him to be kept in custody and yet have some freedom and not to prevent any of his friends from ministering to him. Some days later, Felix arrived with Drusilla. His wife was a Jewess and sent for Paul and heard him speak about faith in Christ Jesus. Well, that's interesting. Roman governor married to a Jewess. And as he was discussing righteousness, self-control, and the judgment to come, Felix became frightened and said, go away for the present, and when I find time, I will summon you. At the same time, too, he was hoping that money would be given him by Paul. Therefore, he also used to send for him quite often and converse with him. But after 2 years had passed, Felix was succeeded by Porcius Festus, and wishing to do the Jews a favor, Felix left Paul in prison. What do you suppose, brethren? In 2 years, could Claudius Lysias make the trip that they accomplished in a day? He'd been summoned. So what was going on in Felix's mind? Felix knows there's no case against this guy. He knows he's got a problem with his own Roman authorities, too, because of it. Paul is a Roman who's been falsely accused now, he knows. He's got problems. And he's got Jews, they're the problem. He lets Paul go, he'll probably get that riot throughout the Roman Empire and get his own throat slit. And so he's got a problem. How do I appeal to Jews? He hopes to buy time and to earn some money by keeping Paul in prison long enough. Then he hopes this guy he deems to be innocent and most interesting and even a little bit scary to, you know, buy him off because he's got a lot of followers. Maybe they'll pool their money and they'll, you know, buy him out. By the way, didn't Paul mention money? He came to Jerusalem bearing what? Alms to the people. So he's a guy that can raise money. So the chapter ends with Felix, I think, very well aware of what's going down here. Paul's still in prison, not about to pay a bribe, and a new administration about to take over.